Well, hello everyone. As you probably know, my name is Michel. Thank you very much for joining us. Today, I am delighted to host Dr. Michel Sexton, who will be talking to us about how can medical cannabis help people with Parkinson's. Dr. Sexton is an integrative medicine specialist and respected pioneer and leader in the field of medical cannabis. She practices medicine in California and speaks and teaches internationally. As always, before we start, I would like to remind everyone that this session is for information and education purposes only. So if you want a diagnostic or if you want advice for your specific situation, please make sure that you consult a medical professional. There will be time for questions at the end of this presentation. If you want to ask a question, please use the Q&A function at the bottom of your screen. Do not use the chat function, please. For those of you who don't know us yet, No Silver Bullet is managed by Mark Lambert and myself, with the aim of sharing Parkinson's expertise. We aim to help you and, very frankly, to motivate you to make informed choices on how to adapt your lifestyle, to manage your symptoms, and hopefully to slow down the disease progression. We post the recordings of our webinars on YouTube and Spotify, and we also post short videos on TikTok and Instagram. The details are available in the chat section at the bottom of your screen, as well as on our website, nosilverbulletforpd.com, nosilverbullet, figure 4pd.com. But let's come back to today's topic and to Michel Sexton, who will be talking to us about how can medical cannabis help people with Parkinson's. Michel, the stage is yours. You're muted, by the way.
Okay, can you hear me now?
Perfectly well. Thank you.
All right. Thank you so much for the invitation to speak today. This is a topic I've been interested in for a very long time, both cannabis and neurological diseases. So I got involved in the integrative applications to neurological diseases through seeking out Dr. Laurie Mishley, who has spoken with you as well, and at my school. She was the person known for applying integrative medicine to neurological conditions. And then I serendipitously was able to formally study the endocannabinoid system, which is part of what we'll be talking about today. I have no disclosures. I was proud to be an editor on this American Herbal Pharmacopoeia of Cannabis, which was published in part back around 2012, and have worked on this therapeutic compendium, which was never published, but I've been involved in a couple of international cannabinoid research organizations since 2008. So I love staying on top of the research. So this is our outline for today. Can you see that outline? These slides are
Perfectly
all
fine. We see very well, Michelle. We see perfectly
okay.
well.
These slides are all numbered, so you'll know where we are. I think I have around 68 slides, but 10 of them are transitional. I aim for a minute a slide, and so it will go a little fast. So just jot down any questions or notes, or if there's a particular slide that you wanted to refer to for a question, then we'll know where to go. So the endocannabinoid system, this is a biological system that's been well defined in the human body, expressed in every tissue in our body, and it's a survival-based system for reasons that we'll talk more about. But we know it's a highly conserved system that can be traced all the way back to very ancient bacteria that were involved in our development as beings with a spinal cord, or what was called a notochord, and that the endocannabinoid system may have first arisen at that time. And it's been described as a system to provide that we eat, sleep, relax, protect, and forget. And so this is a bit of an outline of things that we'll be talking about today. But first, I wanted to just tell you more so you understand this system that the primary active ingredient in cannabis, which I am going to refer to as THC and not CBD, and how this all came about. So we know that opium and the drug morphine or opioids have been used a long time in medical history. And if you trace this back, we can see that this was first described a very long time ago, but also cannabis was described in Chinese medical records. The difference being that morphine got isolated from the opium plant very early, while the active components of cannabis sort of eluded the chemists until 1940 and 1964. And then, similar to how, hey, we have this plant compound, it's having an action in the human body, so our human body must make similar things to this. And this was first described by Candace Pert, who first identified that we had an opioid receptor. The same thing happened for identifying what became known as cannabinoid receptors. So these are proteins that bind what we call ligands or drugs or compounds that our body makes. These compounds in the opioid system are known as endorphins or enkephalins. And in the endocannabinoid system, there are two primary compounds. One is called anandamide, for the Sanskrit word for bliss, or it's also called AEA, and the other one is known as 2-AG. This cannabinoid receptor system, like I said, is in every tissue in our body. And what was known as the cannabinoid 1 receptor has been found primarily expressed in the brain, but also in other parts of the body. But it is the most highly expressed receptor of its type across the brain. So where you see these colors, and the darker orange is indicating higher density. And so, for the purposes of discussing Parkinson's disease, we're often thinking about this central area in the brain called the basal ganglia. And so, you can see that this cannabinoid 1 receptor here is highly expressed. Also, notice here in the cerebellum, which is involved with where we are in space and our balance, but also the prefrontal cortex, which is part of what makes us a thinking, operating human being. The cannabinoid 2 receptor, on the other hand, is not normally found in the brain. So you can see in this tracing, this organ that's very dark is the spleen, because that's where many of our immune cells are stored. And then also, you're seeing lighting up of lymph nodes, and anywhere that there are immune cells or tissues, that is where the CB2 receptor is primarily found. It's been discussed that there's a range of receptors and also what we call channels that cannabinoids and our endocannabinoids act upon. So these are mostly proteins that are in the cell membrane, along with these channels that allow flow of electrons and chloride and sodium, and are sort of like our electrical system. And interestingly, the CB1 receptor is found at the level of the mitochondria, where our energy is being made. And this is where we also generate reactive oxygen species. So the CB1 receptor here has been thought of as a sensor for oxidative stress. And kind of similarly, the CB2 receptor has been shown to be expressed on the what is called the endoplasmic reticulum, which builds our proteins from the building blocks in the nucleus, and that the CB2 receptor is sensing for misfolded proteins. And so this can be of interest in the setting of Parkinson's disease because of the misfolds reported in alpha-synuclein. So what about these compounds our body makes? Are we high all the time because our body is making anandamide and 2-AG? Not necessarily, because they are much lower potency at the receptor than THC is. And I wanted to tell you a little more about them. We call them lipid transmitters. So they're a little bit different from our regular neurotransmitters. And this cartoon is showing how the endocannabinoid system was first described as a homeostatic system. So we're going to start here at this piece of a neuron where we have a neurotransmitter being released. This is glutamate, which is an excitatory neurotransmitter. And as it flows across to bind its receptor at the bottom of the synapse, or where two neurons meet, it binds that receptor, and on demand, endocannabinoid, here showing 2-AG, is made on demand from the cell membrane. It gets transported backwards, or kind of upstream, to bind the cannabinoid 1 receptor, which is at this side of the neurotransmitter junction. And when the CB1 receptor is bound by our endocannabinoid, or THC specifically, it closes calcium channels. And these calcium channels are responsible for the flood of neurotransmitters that come across the cleft. And so this is how it's sort of like a thermostat, but it's a homeostat. It's saying, hey, I got the signal down here. You can stop sending that glutamate or GABA or whatever neurotransmitter it might be, could be involved in this. So again, anandamide or AEA and 2-AG, these are both parts of families of compounds, but these are the two that primarily are working at the endocannabinoid system in our body. There are some cannabinoid drugs on the market. Interestingly, not very many, especially given that we have been intensely studying this system now for coming up on 30 years, 40 maybe. Since THC was isolated, that's what allowed the study of this system. So marinol is a synthetic THC, so identical in structure to the plant compound. And in the United States, it is a scheduled drug, but it's not Schedule I where cannabis is held. Schedule I meaning it has no medicinal value. There is an analog of THC, so that means it's structurally similar to THC. And there's two different ones of it in this mixture called nabilone or sesamet, and it was put on Schedule II. The only plant-derived form of cannabis that's available as a pharmaceutical drug widely is called Sativex and nabiximols, and it is almost a one-to-one mixture of THC together with some other plant components. It has not yet been approved in the United States. It was first developed for treating multiple sclerosis in Great Britain at the request of the MS Society to the National Health Service. The same company that made Sativex has also developed and marketed Epidiolex, which is an isolated form of CBD or cannabidiol. Excuse me. And this was developed for treating intractable pediatric epilepsies. There was a drug that's called an antagonist. So an antagonist blocks the receptor rather than activating the receptor. This was called Acomplia, and it was put on the market to act as a weight loss drug, interestingly, because many people may know or hear that cannabis can stimulate appetite. So it was thought, well, if we can hit that receptor and block it, maybe appetite would be lost. But this drug got withdrawn from the market due to incidents of depression, anxiety, and suicidality in people who were using it. So this just illustrates the importance of this CB1 receptor in our mood. So this is what a transition slide will look like. Every time you see this beautiful leaf from the cannabis plant, we're going to start on a new topic. So I wanted to tell you a bit more about some history of cannabis and its pharmacology. Cannabis is one of the most widely used recreational drugs worldwide. And interestingly, tracking use, especially this was like During the early pandemic, there was this huge increase in cannabis sales to female customers. And we're not going to have a lot of time today to speak specifically to women's health, but we'll talk a little bit more about it later. And among these users are older people. So here's a man saying, "Oh, I'm really feeling my joints today." And his partner following behind him, smoking a joint, saying, "Me too." So this use in older adults was thought to have increased 1,000%. And this was before the pandemic or much of cannabis getting legalized in the United States. And since that time, these numbers in adults over the age of 65 has continued to go up. In women's health, here are a few products that were on the market. This was probably in the early 1900s. Here's one probably for menstrual cramps, dysmenene. Here's an ovarian cannabinoid compound. Here's one for cystitis. And so there's a long history of women being familiar with this use for their health. So we know in ancient China, it was referred to in the written record to treat gout, malaria, digestive disorders, menstrual pain. And then in the 1800s, a doctor from Ireland, Dr. William O'Shaughnessy, went to India, and there he saw cannabis being used as medicine. He reported that he cured a case of tetanus using cannabis. And he was an interesting character who also perfected telegraphy at that time. He was in India so that the communications between Great Britain and India could flow well. And then, past that time, there was a pharmacist who apparently was from Bedfordshire, England, and he held a post as the chemist in ordinary to Queen Victoria, who made an alcoholic tincture of cannabis, which he patented and marketed for analgesia. And apparently, this information was passed to him from O'Shaughnessy. Sir William Gowers, who wrote the Manual of Diseases of the Nervous System, sometimes still used today as a primary reference for neurological diseases, used an extract such as this for tremor, an extract of Indian hemp. So, what is cannabis? It's not just one thing. As we know with many, many plants on our planet, think of roses or lavender, grasses. We just have many, many different types of all of these. And the same holds true for cannabis, especially as breeders have very much hybridized this plant. So, when somebody says, "Well, cannabis might not be good for you," or "it can cause really bad side effects," it's not just one thing. And so all of these statements may not necessarily apply depending on what's in the plant that you've started with or what's in the product that you've got. But we know that the plant is unique in making these compounds called cannabinoids. This is the mother or starting compound known as cannabigerol, and then enzymes in the plant will convert this to THCA and CBDA, which are acid forms of the compound. There's an acid on the structure, which when heated is lost, and THC is not psychoactive until that acid form has been removed by heat. There are a lot of other minor cannabinoids that are really starting to be exploited by the industry. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on those because we have such a tiny amount of information, especially about their effects in human beings. And so you may see or hear of some of these. CBG is an interesting one to potentially be watching, though, in terms of effects for Parkinson's disease. So let's talk specifically about THC. What is this compound? Here's what it looks like. All of these cannabinoids look very similar. So it's got three rings and a tail, and this is what allows it to bind to that cannabinoid receptor. And a very early researcher named Billy Martin designed a behavioral paradigm set of tests for THC and testing drugs they were developing that could act similarly to THC. So in animals, they were looking at slowing of the moving around of the mouse in a cage, sometimes at very high doses, what is called catalepsy, or just totally being immobile, just almost like freezing in space, a reduction in body temperature, and treating pain or analgesia. So we learned from all of these tests across many researchers' labs that THC had effects on, as we saw, neurotransmission, consolidation of memories, our endocrine function, food intake, temperature regulation, immune response, and something we'll talk more about, neuroprotection. What about CBD? CBD had no effects in the tetrad test. And the only difference in the structure of CBD compared to THC is this open ring right here. But this made enough difference that it does not bind to and activate our cannabinoid receptors. In fact, it is actually thought to negatively modulate them or make them less likely to want to perhaps bind THC or other cannabinoids that would activate the receptor. But on its own, it has its own pharmacology and ways that it's acting in the body, many, many different targets. And what's been published are effects on anxiety, psychosis, again, oxidative damage and neuroprotection, and may have this ability to modulate side effects of THC. These experiments were so marked that the United States government, through some researchers working for the US government, filed a patent on cannabinoids as antioxidants and neuroprotectants. So this is really interesting because as to my knowledge, there is not a drug on the market that has a claim of being a neuroprotectant. We have many, many antioxidants that we can access through our diet. And you've probably heard a lot about those already in other talks. So I just wanted to give you a brief overview of some early studies of cannabinoids in Parkinson's disease. So in 1990, here's a case series that was published. People were smoking a low potency cannabis cigarette, one administration, a single time, and they reported no benefit on tremor. Here's that drug nabilone that we saw earlier, and they administered this in a more formal kind of trial. But look at these numbers of patients, often very low numbers across all of these studies. And they did see some improvements in that study. Flash forward to 2004, we've got another survey where their patients are describing some benefit. We've got another controlled trial of Canadore, which is a 1-to-2 mixture of THC and CBD, and they didn't really see much effect. Here's another one where they looked at rimonabant. We were talking about rimonabant as the one that blocks the CB1 receptor. That didn't really have any effect. In 2009, now here's a CBD study up to 400 milligrams per day. And they did see some improvements. Again, remember, these are very small numbers of people. Then we have 2014, 2015, another CBD study. Here's another CBD study. And finally, another one of cannabis. And so you can just get a glimpse that a lot of different types of products, small numbers of people looking at different outcomes. So it's very hard to synthesize this data and give any real information about how it could help people with Parkinson's disease. So we're going to talk a bit about ways to use cannabis and the dosing of cannabis. So this is a diagram that I developed. Just to give a basic understanding that dose matters. So on this axis, we would have the dose of THC, and this arrow showing as you go up in dose, what potentially happens to our endocannabinoid system function. So at a low dose, it may be doing what we would call toning the system, just keeping the receptor there upregulated, ready to do its work. As you go up in the dose, you're just sort of hacking the system because now you're replacing those endocannabinoids with a plant cannabinoid. And you go even higher in dose, and you may actually be suppressing, downregulating the endocannabinoid system and other systems. So we saw glutamate, that excitatory neurotransmitter, and at low dose, the binding of THC to CB1 will be suppressing excitation or just a slowing down of neurotransmitter glutamate. As you go up in dose, likely what starts getting hit are other neurotransmitter systems. And here I just use dopamine and serotonin as examples. And interestingly, at another dose, beyond this very low toning dose, cannabis or THC has been shown to actually facilitate these neurotransmitters. So this is, of course, of interest in Parkinson's disease because we know that dopamine is such a central player and that the endocannabinoid system is modulating these dopaminergic neurons. And in animal studies, THC was shown to increase dopamine synthesis at a certain dose, at low dose. Whereas at high dose, there was decreased dopamine synthesis. So I'm just trying to illustrate that dose very much matters. The same was shown for serotonin in animal models, that at low dose, there seemed to be an antidepressant effect, whereas at high dose, that could be reversed. And the same could hold true for anxiety or at our GABAergic or GABA neurons. And why is this? Well, what's been reported in the literature is that the CB1 receptors that are expressed across these different neurotransmitter systems have different affinity to THC. So the ones at the glutamate receptors have a very high affinity. THC is going to bind there first. And then you think of drugs, then they've bound the receptor, they go out looking for other places where they can bind. And the next level up would be this middle section where we may be facilitating neurotransmitter release. And if you go to very high doses, now these GABAergic neurons have a CB1 receptor where the affinity is much lower, so it's going to bind these GABAergic later in the process. Potentially, but at very high dose. And at very high dose, if you eliminate GABA function, you're actually inhibiting inhibition or maybe allowing for too much excitation in the central nervous system. So, this is some of the way that cannabis is acting on our mood and can explain what being high actually is when you think about neurotransmitters. So when we asked people in a survey that we published back in 2000, I think it was 16, they said that the smell was the number way that they would want to choose their cannabis. These are people who used cannabis mostly in Washington State. They also were looking at THC content and then other things. But I just wanted to say briefly, the smell is also coming from the surface of the plant, where these trichomes are manufacturing the essential oil part of the plant. We don't have a lot of time to talk about that today, but these are also bioactive molecules that are likely modulating the experience of cannabis and can have a very different scent depending on the environment where they're grown or how they were bred. For potency, we know that flower material, whereas it used to be pretty low in potency, the breeding of cannabis has been to increase THC potency. So at the time we did this analysis, we looked at five flower types And you can see the potency was around 20% THC. But then when an extract of the cannabis was made, we've now got upwards to almost 80% THC content. So how you use cannabis and what type of product and the potency makes a big difference. Here's how cannabis works when it is being inhaled, which is really the most studied form of cannabis to date. When you inhale the smoke or vapor, it doesn't have to be burned, it's very rapidly, you can see this is within minutes, reaching a very high peak in the bloodstream. And notice this number, we'll come back to a number later, 140 nanograms. So this is maybe somebody just smoking a regular cannabis joint or cigarette. And then you also see how quickly the THC is leaving the bloodstream. This is because THC loves, loves, loves fat. It's actually what makes it a bad drug to be so highly lipophilic. But what this means is it's leaving the bloodstream and going out into the tissues. And by doing this, it mostly avoids the liver. And this dotted line is representing a liver metabolite of THC that is also as active as THC at the receptor. The way that people may inhale cannabis without smoking is through a vaporizer. So this is just an example of two different devices that heat the plant material without burning it. So you're not inhaling the ash or the byproducts of combustion that we know can really harm the lungs. When we go to look at how this may compare to orally ingested cannabis products, and I'm not endorsing any of these, I'm just showing that there are many, many bottled or liquid types and edible types of products available. This green line is now showing how reduced the bioavailability is. Look at this nanograms per mil now, way down here below 5. We were at 140 with the inhaled version. I think this might have been a 10 milligram dose of THC from the study. And now what can happen is that the liver processes, because it's been ingested, it's going first pass through the liver and then into the bloodstream. And so based on individual genetics of our metabolizing enzymes, somebody could make a whole lot of this metabolite really quickly. Other people might not make as much of it or make it more slowly. So it's a lot more variable taken orally than when inhaled. The benefit of the oral is it's not as quick acting. You can see the peak here, maybe not even until 2 hours. But this active metabolite, having this little hydroxy compound, seems to make it a little friendlier to being in circulation longer, and so thereby having a more prolonged effect than with inhalation. What about Parkinson-associated symptoms? Let's talk specifically about the areas eat, sleep, relax, protect, and forget. So first of all, we know the endocannabinoid system is involved in these activities. This is why another reason that it is a survival-based system. It provides that we have an appetite. It is involved in our metabolizing of nutrients and energy making, our digestion, our gut motility, and inflammation in the gut. We know from animal studies if you knock that cannabinoid receptor out of animals, they lose their appetite and they will eat less than wild type animals who still have that CB1 receptor. And if we give anandamide to animals, it enhances their appetite and they eat more. And then we also knew from old historical written records and people using cannabis that it could be anti-emetic or help stop nausea and vomiting and stimulate appetite. And so this is what led to the development of Marinol, the first drug that I showed you earlier. The synthetic THC was approved in the United States in 1985, and this was associated with the AIDS epidemic, HIV/AIDS, and the related anorexia and weight loss. And here in a study of people with taking cancer chemotherapy, they gave this drug Marinol twice a day and showed that there was enhanced chemosensory perception, that food smelled better, or they thought food even sounded good to them more, and their appetite improved and they ate more calories. What about the effects on the gut? Here was a study just published in 2019 where recent marijuana use was associated with a decreased odds of constipation. And a lot of people who may be using cannabis for pain ask about this because compared to opioids, they want to know, is this going to cause me constipation? And we do know that THC can slow gut motility. But it doesn't seem to slow motility in people with a normally functioning gut, but in people who are having very rapid motility, it may play a role in slowing motility. What about sleep? I think that this is one of the prime areas for cannabis use in Parkinson's disease. So again, we know the endocannabinoid system is involved in our circadian function, in promoting what we call slow wave sleep, or that very deep, restful, restorative sleep. It's been shown to treat insomnia in animals. We don't know if this is modulating serotonin specifically, but it was tried in a study of sleep apnea. There's not a lot of study of cannabis for sleep, despite that there's a lot of talk about it and that people use it a lot for sleep. So here's what a normal sleep architecture should look like, that you fall asleep, you go into this deep restorative sleep, you come back out, you have some REM, and you do this over multiple cycles per night, with more REM hopefully occurring toward morning. And so at night, when we're in this deep restorative sleep, what has been learned is that the waves of the brain are all starting to be synchronized with each other, and that this is involved in a pumping motion of our cerebrospinal fluid. So, really important in cleaning debris out of the brain, and this would be misfolded proteins or other metabolites of just daily function of the brain. And this is why sleep is so important. We know that the basal ganglia circuits are playing a role, and that there is impaired circadian function in many people with Parkinson's disease, right? You may have seen this data before, published in 2014, where they measured melatonin across a circadian cycle and showed that people with excessive daytime sleepiness had even less melatonin than those without excessive daytime sleepiness. And not shown here, that people with Parkinson's disease also have reduced melatonin production compared to healthy people. And we know that as we age, melatonin production can decline. There is evidence that melatonin helps prevent oxidative damage to the dopamine-producing cells. So here is a graph showing if you take melatonin, how rapidly it is metabolized. So the half-life of melatonin is recorded to be 20 to 40 minutes long. L-DOPA halftime is 2 hours, just for comparison. And so in under the blue curve is a formulation of melatonin designed to be released more slowly and over time. Why is this important? May not be able to see this area of the graph as easily. But this is just showing that in serum or in saliva, that the peak of melatonin is supposed to occur at about 2 to 4 a.m. So I just wanted this to illustrate that if you take melatonin at bedtime or an hour before, it is likely to almost be totally cleared from the system by the time it should be peaking at 2 to 4 a.m. So use of sometimes a short and a long-acting melatonin may be the most beneficial. So here's the data from the THC study for apnea. So they did what they called a representative tracing of this is that ultradian rhythm or the sleep architecture that we looked at before. And these ziggity lines just showing that there wasn't a strong rhythm. If it was a strong rhythm, these gray lines would be following the black lines exactly. And then here's one post giving the dronabinol. This was 10 milligrams, but they gave a dose from 2.5 up to 10. And so they were claiming that it was strengthening this ultradian rhythm. And you may hear people say, oh, cannabis is bad for sleep. It is as bad as alcohol. Well, again, remember that dose matters. So it may actually be strengthening the ultradian rhythm. We know from an early study that inhalation of cannabis in a cannabis cigarette caused a release of melatonin, and we know that THC has sedative effects. Well, what about the next day? What if you take cannabis? Are you going to feel groggy the next day? Here is a study of 20 adults that was done in Australia. They had two 24-hour sessions where they administered a combination of THC along with CBD. And then they, on the next morning or 10 hours after ingesting this, they did a bunch of psychomotor assessments, including a simulation of driving. And what did they find? No differences between those who took the dose or took the placebo. They did see a small increase among people saying they felt sedated, but they didn't measure any impairment in any of the tests or the tasks that they assigned to these people. So I don't even typically use a 10 milligram dose of THC. So I also do not have patients generally reporting impairment, feeling high, or groggy the next morning after using cannabis for sleep. Here is a study where they've been looking at nabilone. They looked backwards at some of the people who used the nabilone, and in 38 people, they saw improved overall sleep. They said it was well tolerated. And in general, they saw improvement of non-motor symptom burden, sleep problems, and pain with this particular drug. What about CBD and sleep? So CBD is being actively marketed as like a miracle cure for everything out there. I am not so much on that bandwagon because I just clinically don't see the happening what the claims are. Now, given, I think that many people may be using cannabis that has some THC in it, and they actually prefer to say they're using CBD rather than using cannabis. So it can be tricky, but I just wanted to say, in particular for sleep, that in rats, it was shown to reduce melatonin synthesis. At low dose, CBD has actually been called alerting. So kind of like a stimulant, but just maybe a bit of a cognitive stimulant. In a single dose, I want to say it was 300 milligram. It didn't alter any of that ultradian rhythm that we saw associated with THC. There was this one study, 160 milligrams a day was associated with an increase in sleep time and decrease of arousals. It was specifically looked at in 33 people with REM sleep behavior disorder. It was tolerated well and thought to maybe suppress some of these behaviors, but didn't really show a reduction in these manifestations, but a transient improvement at a 300 milligram dose. There was no reduction in the severity of restless leg syndrome in patients with Parkinson's disease and RBD. So the dose of CBD is much, much higher than an effective dose of THC. And sometimes you're getting into doses that may actually be associated with drug-drug interactions. And so, to actually get the benefit of CBD and the dose needed can require being watchful, perhaps for effects on the liver. Here's just an example of an 87-year-old male. He had atypical Parkinsonism. Here's the drugs he was on. Typically, I'm using a fast and slow acting melatonin in these patients that are having great difficulty with their sleep. along with THC. So he was having an oral cannabis product at night, and this protocol helped him sleep well through the night and also had some improvement in his daytime tremor when he slept better. His care provider said he's sleeping very well, only a few nights of sleep disturbance. The one thing is, occasionally he does wake up in the middle of the night sometimes, and then he might just then use an inhalation with his vaporizer because that's so fast acting to help him get back to sleep. What about relaxing or anxiety? We know again that the endocannabinoid system controls the stress response. It's homeostatic for our cortisol release. It's been downregulated in people with PTSD. When we asked people about their cannabis use, the top three reasons they said they used cannabis were for pain, anxiety, and depression. And pain has been pretty well studied for cannabis effects, but anxiety and depression and these behavioral symptoms, not as much. There's a lot of controversy around it. Here are a number of different surveys. Here's our survey right here, which is a large number of people. So this is the number of people they surveyed. And this is the percent of responders who said they got anxiety benefit from cannabis. So you can see it was from almost 40% up to above 60% of people saying, I get anxiety benefit from cannabis. We did a sub-analysis of this where we had asked people, are you substituting cannabis for other types of drugs? And again, we saw yes for pain medications, yes for anti-anxiety drugs, and yes for antidepressants. And again, some other studies saw this same thing, smaller percent of people reducing medications, but reporting that they may substitute cannabis for their anti-anxiety medications. Again, don't forget, dose matters because anxiety induction is an important area where people can get into trouble with the dosing specifically of THC. What about our immune system? Well, the endocannabinoid system is regulating many, many things around our immune system. We talked about this role at the mitochondria for oxidative stress. And then the interesting thing to think about, and this is what the lab that I worked in at the University of Washington was studying, were these specialized immune cells in the brain called microglia and how they're involved in neuroinflammation. So this is a diagram that I made for a proposal we submitted to study cannabis for COVID. So you're seeing the COVID virus here. But also any kind of, so this is the neuron. Then we have these helper cells called glia that are there helping our neurons and protecting them. And these microglia, you can see, have these many, many arms because they are sensors. They're sensing for, is there anything happening? Do I need to be on alert? Do I need to become activated and help protect the brain? So in neuronal damage, like in the case of Parkinson's disease, these damage-associated molecular patterns are going to wake our immune system up. So these microglia become activated. This is showing immune cells that may migrate into the brain in the setting of neuroinflammation. And this is our CB2 receptor. It gets upregulated in inflammation. Why does it get upregulated? Because the endocannabinoid system is bringing the immune system back to homeostasis. So we need our endocannabinoid binding this cannabinoid receptor. And what happens is that it actually shifts this microglia from being a pro-inflammatory type of cell to being an anti-inflammatory type of cell. And we have some data from people living with HIV that very much supports this model and what we see in animals all the time. My particular research was in multiple sclerosis, and this was very early in the study of cannabis, so it was kind of a crude study where we didn't analyze what people were using. Mostly what people were using was inhaled cannabis. But we looked at healthy people, those are the black bars. Oh, I'm sorry, healthy is on the left, people with MS on the right. The black bars are people who used no cannabis. And they're on the white bars are people who used cannabis. So There wasn't any change in this, what we call a chemokine that attracts immune cells, but we did see what we considered to be a global reduction of cytokines, not only in patients with MS, but also healthy controls. So this is just illustrating the anti-inflammatory potential of cannabis. And then I want you to know that other plants have compounds that interact with our endocannabinoid system. So on a daily basis, you could be eating foods or using herbs that are modulating your endocannabinoid system or toning it at a very low level. So echinacea is a very popular one, it has been one of the most popular herbs in the past. It contains a compound or a group of compound called alkylamides that have been shown to bind that CB2 receptor. So remember, binding the receptor is going to be anti-inflammatory, and there's even some evidence that by reducing inflammation, you reduce anxiety. This is another CB2 receptor agonist, so activating that receptor, which we want in the setting of inflammation. It's called beta-caryophyllene, and this is one you can smell. It is an aromatic compound. It's found in cloves, it's in black pepper, it's in lemon balm, it's in rosemary. So this is something you could be actually ingesting on a daily basis. I love black pepper. I'm always doing a black pepper extract when I'm making my vegetables at dinner. And that recently it was also shown to inhibit the breakdown of our endocannabinoid 2-AG. So just remember, this is low dose that we're getting in foods and just for the purpose of toning our system. Wanted to step back just a minute to this King's American Dispensatory, where back in the early 1900s, Harvey Wicks Felter discussed cannabis. And I'm not going to read all of this, but basically concluded it was preferable to opium as a remedy for pain. It ranks among the first, and the more spasmodic the pain, the better it acts, administered in painful states of the stomach. So this is an area where Parkinson patients may find utility for cannabis as well. Here is a systematic review, so looking at back at what kind of studies, randomized controlled trials or cohort studies? This is the numbers of people they looked at. Of course, again, now we're talking about a variety of different products with different amounts of THC or CBD. But what they found was immoderate improvements in pain severity. There was a sublingual spray, which is the Sativex that we talked about. And then when these types of analyses are done, they usually do this plot that is called a forest plot. And so the diamond here that I've highlighted in red is just showing that their synthesis of all the literature published favors cannabinoids for treating pain. And here I go again. I'm going to talk about dose. These biphasic effects have been reported across the literature. So, an early paper on a review of the endocannabinoid system said that the psychological effects of cannabis and THC are biphasic, bidirectional, depend on the mode of administration, the dose, personality, time frame, degree of tolerance, and other individual factors. So, like many drugs, it can't necessarily be one dose is the best dose for everyone. And with THC, we know that at low dose, it can benefit anxiety and pain. Here, I've just put a suggestion of the percent THC potency in a flower that might be affiliated with these low doses. As you go up in dose at 10 milligrams, most people report that they have an induction of anxiety or maybe even start having paranoia. And then you go up to much, much higher doses, and people can go into psychotic episodes or have psychoses, and interestingly, lose the pain benefit. Excuse me. CBD has the same thing reported in the literature that at low dose, CBD may be alerting, and that as you go up in dose, it can be more sedative or treat anxiety or maybe even potentially be an antipsychotic compound, and that was studied in patients with schizophrenia. But again, it's this dose of CBD and the potential drug-drug interaction that leaves it as sort of a big question mark on whether or not to try those doses. But everywhere across cannabis users, they typically say that they find their own sweet spot for a dose. This was reported in, this was a study of inhaled or vaporized cannabis for treating diabetic neuropathic pain. And so Dr. Wallace, who is the chair of our pain division at UCSD, published this data showing as the dose of the THC went up, the pain benefit was lost. And this is the actual nanograms per milliliter of THC. And so again, he's reporting that there was this sweet spot in terms of the dose where the best pain benefit occurred. And if you remember that inhaled number, was 140 nanograms per milliliter. So this is inhaling very low potency cannabis, about 5%. And so that's going to give you more of this blood level of THC that may provide pain benefit. What about the cognitive effects? Well, we know that again, the endocannabinoid system is regulating our brain plasticity, how our brain's constantly adapting to what's coming in for us, whether it's our memory, remembering things, trying to forget things, our neurotransmitters, pruning neurons we don't need anymore, and our perception of pain. And this was an interesting study in mice where they took older mice and younger mice, they gave them low dose THC and reported that they restored cognitive function in the older mice to a level of that similar to that of the young untreated mice. And so their conclusion was THC could target specifically degenerative events occurring in human aging brain. We're waiting for more on this, right? Because we know we're entering an epidemic of Alzheimer's and dementia, and there's going to be a real need for modulating this. So here's a study of dispensary-used cannabis for neuropsychiatric symptoms in people with dementia. These are mostly subjective reports from caregivers, but they were looking at neuropsychiatric symptoms of agitation, aggression, insomnia, irritability, lability, anxiety. 79% reporting that THC was effective in improving many of these symptoms. So this is just showing who these people were. You can see the average age around 80. They had different reasons for their dementia diagnosis. And again, here's this report by the caregivers of showing an antipsychotic reduction, use in antipsychotic medications. Some kept the dose the same, some decreased the dose, and then there were some that stopped the antipsychotics entirely. So this is some of the preliminary evidence coming out on the potential utility. What about psychosis and PD? There was a study of cannabidiol, which showed that it was effective, safe, and well tolerated. And this was a range of doses. They used the Brief Psychiatric Rating Scale. They saw a rapid onset of benefit with no worsening of motor function. And that the people getting this highest dose or one of the higher doses per day had reduced total scores in the PDQ-39, which you may have had this test before, but it's measuring activities or dimensions of daily living. But they did say we can't really conclude anything. And this is often, again, because it's small numbers of people, they're just pilot studies. What do people say about the effects of cannabis on their cognitive function? So we asked this in our survey, and in this graph, I've got older people, which we defined as over 50, compared to young people and sort of middle aging. But I just found it interesting that you can see the bars are shorter here when we asked about concentration, word finding, forgetfulness, short-term memory problems, compared to the younger cohorts. Why is this? Well, there was a suggestion that maybe the older people were shopping for less potent THC, and so they had less cognitive effect. But also, maybe older people just already had these symptoms and they were used to them and it didn't really worsen them. We have not followed up on this research. Again, and this was now looking at purple is medical users, they're saying it improved concentration, that they felt more articulate or communicative, that they felt it increased their motivation or drive, and that they felt less anxious and fearful. So these are just some positive effects that cannabis users, people who use cannabis and like cannabis, obviously say are benefits that they get. And one of the final things I wanted to talk about is this concept of interoception, because it has been looked at in Parkinson's disease that people with Parkinson's, or some people with Parkinson's with certain symptoms, may have this reduced interoception. And this is our ability to read our body signals, like, am I hungry? Do I need to go to the bathroom? Am I thirsty? So it's sort of just paying attention. And one way that this can be measured is whether or not you can feel your own heartbeat without actually, putting your fingers over a vein. Can you sense your heartbeat and can you count it accurately? So we know that this lack of interoception has been associated with depression, anxiety, anhedonia, apathy. So these are things that people with PD may be struggling with. What does this have to do with cannabis? Well, a THC challenge was shown to alter brain perfusion, especially in the areas of the brain associated with interoceptive awareness. So I've often told people in terms of THC effects, one of them is that it tends to just sort of bring you into the present moment. We know that it has the ability to slow time perception. And so I think of this as like being in the present moment, that the present moment is just right here. And that kind of can bring you into your body to really help feel into your body. All right, so we're going to wrap this up with what does the research tell us? Here's a review. In animal models, prospects for cannabinoid therapies in basal ganglia disorders. So, they were also talking about some other neurological diseases in this paper, but they found across studies that cannabinoids were antioxidant and neuroprotective. Here's that same recurring theme coming up, that CB2 receptor agonists, so we talked about those being in plants, may reduce inflammatory events. And that CB1 agonist, so that CB1 receptor in the brain, may reduce tremor in animal models. The issue's not yet clear in patients. Here's a meta-analysis, again, looking specifically at Parkinson's disease in animal models, concluding that there is evidence for efficacy, that there is some suggestion of improvement in motor functions, and of course, we need more study, right? Well, here's another meta-analysis. This was published in 2022 in the Journal of Parkinson's Disease. These were 18 randomized controlled trials, usually controlled with a placebo, 18 non-randomized studies, and they found some potential benefit relative to tremor, anxiety, pain, sleep quality, quality of life, things that we've talked about today. And that there is a need for more investigation in these areas. Here's a survey that came out in 2015. These PD patients in this cohort found cannabis rated the most effective for improvements in mood, sleep, motor symptoms, quality of life. Nabilone has been investigated for mostly non-motor symptoms, so found to be beneficial, and that's that analog of THC that's given as a drug. And here is a study of pretty good number of people where 73% were reporting medical cannabis use and where higher blood levels, and this is higher than we talked about for pain, was associated with improvement in bradykinesia or rigidity. Most of the patients reported this improvement occurring within 2 months after starting cannabis use. Here is the health effects of cannabis and cannabinoids report from the United States National Academy of Science, Engineering, and Medicine. And they said there was no or insufficient evidence either to support or refute that cannabis or cannabinoids were an effective treatment for motor symptoms in Parkinson's disease or levodopa-induced dyskinesia. Briefly, I just wanted to touch on potential adverse effects. So, something we didn't really talk about yet was our cardiovascular system, where the endocannabinoid system is involved in the homeostasis of our blood pressure and our hematologic system. So, we know this cannabinoid receptor on our blood vessels and the smooth muscle, that dilates and contracts our blood vessels can be affected by THC, and our endocannabinoids are doing this job. So, especially with inhalation, because of that rapid uptake and delivery to the tissues, there can be a transient drop in blood pressure. So, this is very relevant, especially for any of you that already have hypotension, right? Because you could potentiate these hypotensive effects. So, what happens is, the blood will drop to your feet, especially if you stand up, and then the heart's going to start pumping harder and faster to try to get the blood back up to the brain. So it can feel like a panic attack. You could get close to having a syncope or passing out from a very low blood pressure. And for a lot of people, even taking it orally, they sometimes notice an increase in heart rate. So this could be particularly relevant if you're anemic and your heart rate is already fast, or if you have any kind of a heart condition. What about adverse effects? Sedative? I hope you got the message that this is dose dependent. So cannabis at very low dose may actually be stimulating. What about driving? Nobody has studied low dose for driving. We did see that one study, the morning after study, after using cannabis for sleep, that it didn't impair driving ability in a driving simulator. What about leading to hallucinations or psychosis or delirium? Well, again, I hope you remember this chart that that's going to happen at very, very high doses. Not to say, though, that there can be individual effects, and especially in disease processes, it's always good to just stick with very low dose until you know yourself how you tolerate it. And so, the things specifically in Parkinson's to be watchful for are issues around balance that THC could affect. If you have pre-existing dizziness, it could worsen that. If you're hypotensive, it could exacerbate hypotension. And then, the most common, other common thing that older people report is a dry mouth. And again, these are dose-related effects, and can be very individual. So, should you just wait until there's a study for you to join? Well, cannabis is really hard to study because of the way it's scheduled across our planet as a dangerous plant or, no medical value. And I just did a brief review at our clinicaltrials.gov, and I found only two studies currently listed there. I don't know if anyone else is tracking studies of cannabis for Parkinson's disease, like the HOPE list. But unless you're in these areas, you couldn't really join a study. So, what can you do? You can do your own individual therapeutic trial. And this is what I do with patients. We go through their specific Parkinson's symptoms and really drill into where might cannabis be the most helpful for this person and at what dose would it be the safest. Charcot, who was a famous French neurologist, said, "If you do not have a proven treatment for certain illnesses, bide your time, do what you can, but do not harm your patients." And in this book, Dying to Get High, written by Wendy Chapkus, who was a sociologist who went and lived among people who were working in a cannabis garden making their own medicine, they said, "A present tense focus may not feel altering so much as enhancing in the context of terminal illness or chronic disease. It produces a positive shift, and I can go on to something else. It stops the fear, it stops the worrying. I don't really think there's anything wrong with dulling the reality of my situation." And so, keeping in mind that this consciousness altering property of cannabis is actually related to its medicinal value. That's it. Thank you for your attention. These are my two lovely granddaughters, and I have their endorsement. And if you want to learn more specifically about women's health, this is a book that I published recently that really drills into this whole dosing paradigm and specifics for women's health across the lifespan.
Michelle, thank you very much for this. It was an
You're
amazing
welcome.
presentation. It touched on so many aspects of cannabis, the use of cannabis for Parkinson's. It is a much wider scope than I would have anticipated. Thank you so much. Let's just have a look at some of the questions that have come through. Someone anonymous is basically saying, I use cannabis gummies to help me sleep better, both to fall asleep and to stay asleep. The dose is between 5 and 10 milligrams. And the questions are there any long-term side effects such as lethargy that might develop out of the use of cannabis? And do you develop a tolerance over time that requires a higher dose, that you need to increase the dose over time?
So the first part was about lethargy. Is that what I heard?
Yes, would it have long-term side effects such as lethargy developing over time? And
Oh, okay.
the second one is about tolerance over time and the need for a higher dose developing over time.
Both great questions. So the data or the evidence we have about your questions mainly go back to the study drug Sativex and its use in people with multiple sclerosis. And so what those studies, which have been going ongoing since about 2004, can teach us is that when people who used Sativex were followed over a long period of time, and I want to say it was out to at least 6 months, it might have been a year, they did not find that once people found their sweet spot or their dose that worked best for them, that they had to keep escalating that dose. So we don't think that unless you're using very, very heavily, that tolerance develops. And we don't know exactly what that definition of heavy is. And so that would, I think, also apply to this question about lethargy. If you're using it during the day, it could be a little sedating. I find that very variable across people, but I don't know that anybody's looked at over time. Does it cause that effect?
Understood. A question from Lisa. It's a point you mentioned in your presentation about gastrointestinal mobility. She basically noticed that you mentioned that THC relieves constipation or may relieve constipation, but at the same time, she saw a study that I think you mentioned from 2023 by the AGA that was saying that the THC slows the gastrointestinal mobility. So she just wanted to understand a tiny bit your source or a bit more information about the effect of THC on the gastrointestinal system, please.
I think that maybe she misunderstood because I don't think that I said that THC relieves constipation. I think I said
Okay.
that it would not cause constipation like an opioid does. And it is true that it slows gastrointestinal motility, but that is typically in a situation where the motility is too fast. If someone's having diarrhea, for instance, it can happen in many, many different cases, but it doesn't appear to slow motility to the point that it causes constipation.
Understood. Another question from Lisa while we are at it. She basically, her understanding, and she's ready to be corrected if she's wrong, her understanding is that long-standing cannabis use coupled with sustained incidence of poor sleep can be the perfect storm for to trigger seizures. Is that something that you are aware of or have come across?
No, I've never seen that. I
Yeah,
mean,
that's
just
great.
missing sleep is so bad on its own. And so, yeah, you have to be very careful if you're treating someone who's, perpetually sleep deprived because it is going to affect many neurotransmitter systems.
Yes, absolutely. So someone is asking actually about the UK specifically, which is not probably your cup of tea, or a tiny bit less than the US. But that person is basically saying that from what you say, THC is needed, not just CBD. We agree with that. And that person is under the impression that it is not legal in the UK. Now, I'm based in the UK and I'm using THC legally. So I just wanted to basically to say to that person, please reach out to me directly by email if you want. And I'm very happy to share with you. I don't want to bother the whole audience with the UK specific situation, but I'm very happy to share my experience and the way you can access THC. Now, Jill is referring to the fast and slow acting melatonin that you recommend. And she wanted a bit more information. She said that she has difficulty finding slow acting forms of melatonin.
Well, of course, that's going to vary depending on where you live, what part of the world, right? I know we have a number of brands in the United States that make either a PR prolonged release or SR sustained release form.
Yes.
The fast acting that I use is usually sublingual, so it dissolves under the tongue and gets into the system pretty quickly. And then within 30 minutes, I find most people feeling sleepy from that fast acting. And then I tell them when they're going to lay down to sleep. And once they're feeling sleepy, that's when they're going to swallow the sustained release form of the melatonin, maybe along with a THC dose if it's a severe insomnia.
Understood. Another question from an anonymous attendee asking, it's probably something very personal to each patient, of course, but what is the best, most effective dose of THC that PD patients can take?
Yeah, I would be remiss, I think, to give a single dose. And the sort of the collective wisdom about THC is to start low and go slow. And so in my patient evaluation, I'm usually getting enough information from the patient that gives me a good idea of what I think a good starting dose for that person would be. Whether it's a half a milligram of THC or 2.5 milligrams. So I'm getting that from the patient intake on a lot of the things that I'm asking about.
Perfect. And I have actually from Pilar exactly the same kind of question. She with the question being, what ratio of THC to CBD would you recommend for motor symptoms? And what method of delivery, oral or inhaled? Now, maybe you can make some general points about this because, of course, it will be depending on each patient, I'm sure.
Yeah, and that's a great question. So I really follow the evidence base. And if we look at that evidence base, again, Sativex, that 1-to-1 ratio, is the most studied form of cannabis out there. So I'm often just sticking with that 1-to-1 because you can find in the market all these crazy different ratios and people making claims about this ratio versus that ratio, but we don't actually have research supporting a one ratio over another. So I'm typically dosing is based on the THC effect because we know that THC at low dose likely is having little effect in general. So whatever the ratio is, I'm always looking at what's the dose of THC. And in terms of reaching the brain, my experience in patients with neurological diseases are that I think that inhaled form is delivering the amount to the brain that may likely be the most beneficial. Whether for tremor or spasticity in multiple sclerosis or some other neurological diseases. So I am an advocate of doing the inhalation with the vaporized form of cannabis, but again, it's always typically at very low potency, which people cannot necessarily always find.
I understand. So David is sending us a message from Germany. First of all, thanking you for a fantastic presentation. I agree with that.
Oh, thank you.
He says he's lucky to live in Germany, where the recent change in law in relation to legality of homegrown cannabis has been beneficial. He's asking if there are specific strains that you would suggest to use for PD or generally any indica strain with approximately 5% THC. So this is a home grower question.
That kind of opens the whole can of worms about the hybridization of the plant because the indica and the sativa designation we don't even really know what those are. We know that at the time they were given those species names, it was based on how the plant looked. So an indica was a bushy, wide-leafed plant that was not necessarily real tall, that grew in certain areas, whereas the sativa cannabis plant was this very tall, airy, thin-leafed plant. Well, nobody looked at the chemical constituents at that time. That was all based on the phenotype or what we could see of the plant. And so those terms have really been adopted by the industry where we don't even know anymore, what a plant is. Many are called hybrids. And then we have this whole other essential oil component that is not being well defined for consumers. So to answer the question, I think that a terpene called pinene, which you smell in a pine forest, and its closely related compound terpenylene, are one. It's one of my favorite types to look for because that pinene seems to have a very stimulating effect cognitively and physically because it's pinene and THC have been shown to inhibit the breakdown of acetylcholine. It's that acetylcholine at our nerve muscle junction and in our brain that's given us that cognitive flash. So, if you can smell it, you might smell the pinene. But we know in California that the hybridization has really lost the biodiversity of the plant. And so it's very difficult even to find things that have pinene in them anymore. So those indicas, which are thought to be more of a heavy or sedating type of cannabis, may have other terpenes in them, like linalool from lavender, or one called myrcene that we know is sedative. And so, in the setting of Parkinson's disease, I don't. Most of my PD patients don't want to be sedated. They're looking for that, up, more of an up experience.
Yes.
So the indica might be good at night. But in the day, is it going to exacerbate bradykinesia or, other symptoms? We don't know.
Thank you very much. Brian is asking whether patches are the best delivery format. You didn't touch on that one.
No, because, we have so little data on the transdermal delivery, and we know that there are ways to deliver things transdermally. But in terms of it getting in systemically and getting a high level in the blood that might be therapeutically efficacious, that's the big question mark. Because remember, we have a lot of fat under our skin. And what do cannabinoids love? Fat. So they may accumulate under our subcutaneous, in our subcutaneous fat, and then get released so slowly into our bloodstream that you don't really perceive the benefit.
Yes, thank you very much. Dave is asking if there is any evidence that CBD can help with freezing of gait.
I don't know of a mechanism that CBD would help with that. And I have not seen any study of that. So I know somebody else mentioned the CAN PD trial for psychosis, so maybe that's something they're tracking in that study. I don't know.
Talking about psychosis, Robert is asking if you have anything to say about the CAN PD trial. I think you mentioned it in one of your last slides,
Yeah, I mean,
or maybe I'm mistaken.
I know that it's going on. I don't think they've released any kind of result at this point. Probably the rationale from that for that study came from the trial in patients with schizophrenia, where they showed an antipsychotic effect. But remember again that that was a very, very high dose, sometimes above 1,000 milligrams. So as we move forward in the industry and in the making of medicines, we will hopefully formulate CBD to be have better bioavailability, where we don't have to take these enormous doses that could then potentially harm the liver or have drug-drug interactions with other drugs.
Thank you very much. Krista is asking about addiction and how addictive is cannabis. Now, in the doses we're talking about, is this an issue? Should we be worried about it if we're taking it?
From animal studies, it's not generally thought of as a drug of abuse like other types of drugs that very much stimulate a huge flood of dopamine release. I worked in a lab where we worked alongside another lab where they actually would insert a little tube into the animal brain where they could measure neurotransmitter. And they were studying cocaine and, you know, drugs that cause this flood of dopamine. And then when they did the studies with THC, you don't see that same dopamine flood. So it's more just like a trickle. I think of it as like this nice trickle of dopamine that does can enhance mood and motivation, but not to that degree of, oh, I gotta have some more, I gotta have some more. And especially in people, you know, with illness, it's often just bringing them back to a baseline of feeling more normal and like healthy people rather than, you know, acting strongly as a drug.
Now, Brian, who asked about the patch, has a couple of more questions on how to administer the CBD and the THC. And he basically is asking whether the respiratory format, so the inhaler, he was under the impression that that a lot of the compound might be lost before getting to the brain. Is that the case?
A lot of the compound?
The lot of the THC CBD combination would be lost before getting to the brain.
Well, it depends on what you're using. So, one of the early forms of vaporizing cannabis was a device called the Volcano, made by a German company. And so, it kind of looks like a volcano, and there's a thing in the middle. You put the cannabis flower, and then there's this big plastic bag that with the vapor, you take the bag off and you're inhaling it this pla from this plastic bag. Well, we know cannabinoids stick to plastic really easily. So now, you know, like here's a device. It's got a very short pathway to delivery from the chamber to the mouthpiece. And yeah, you have to go clean it out over time because the resin of the plant builds up. So there is some loss, but you get plenty vapor when you use a device like this.
How does that compare to oil, drops of oil that you put under your tongue?
Drops of oil. Well, oil does not get absorbed under the tongue, and cannabinoids are not going to jump out of the oil into your mucosa. So usually when people like the Sativex spray, you know, you would think that that might be a rapid Sativex is sprayed into the mouth. So it was designed to get absorbed in the oral mucosa, the mucosa of the mouth tissue. And if you look at their timeline, it's not fast. People are still mostly swallowing it. And so the peak time is still around that 2 hour time point that I showed with ingesting cannabis. So that could be a capsule, a liquid. There are now nano formulations that seem to be speeding up. Like here in California, we have all these drinks. I mean, Pabst Blue Ribbon is making a cannabis drink, and those tend to be pretty quick, but again, not long lasting, interestingly.
Thank you very much. I just thought I don't do that very often, being the host and not the presenter, but I just wanted to briefly share my positive experience with THC and CBD in the UK for insomnia. Like many people with Parkinson's, I started developing increasing difficulty sleeping at night, falling asleep and waking up so many times. That my nights were 3 or 4 hours long, which is debilitating. And I've been using THC legally in the UK for the last 3 months. And that, together with small doses of levodopa, very small doses during the night, has helped me regain the sleep. And so I just wanted to share that very briefly with the audience. Of course, everyone's situation will be different. I'm not saying it works for everyone, but in my case, and I basically, we had booked this session well before I started using THC, so there was no particular agenda from my side. But coincidentally, I started being a user of drops of oil under my tongue. That's the reason why I was asking. That's why it is delivered over here and very successful. So I will not say any more about that, but just in passing, Nico is thanking us for an excellent presentation. Pradeep is asking whether the slides will be available later. Will that be the case, Michel?
Whether what would be
Will you be
available?
sharing your, will you be sharing your slides? Are you comfortable sharing your slide with the audience?
Can. Would you want me to send them to you or how
To
would I?
Mark or to me, and then we will make them available. But then, so Pradeep, the answer is yes, the slides will be available. And Carolina is basically apologizing for arriving a bit late. And will the presentation be, will it be available later? Yes, it is being recorded. It will be posted on YouTube. It will be there in a couple of days. So Michel, thank you very, very much. It was an amazing presentation on the topic. Oh no, it's a pleasure. You are one of the best specialists in the world on that topic. And it is a topic that is not very often spoken about. And definitely not with the amount of detail you gave us today, which was absolutely illuminating for all of us, I'm sure. So before I let our audience go, I just wanted to say that our next session will be taking place on the 13th of May, when I will have the pleasure of interviewing Michael Okun. And I'm sure that most of you will know Michael Okun already from his predominance in the world of Parkinson's, but he's really one of the thought leaders in the Parkinson's research. And I will have the pleasure of talking to him on the 13th of May, so invitations will follow in a week or two. Thank you very much, Michelle. Thank you to our audience, and see you soon.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.